year ago. What of your own loyalty? Have you ever been in her position, pursued by a suitor you do not desire, in addition to her other responsibilities? Any woman in such a state is apt to say things she might later regret. Only you compound that regret mightily through your righteous indignation and your wing's antipathy. Dara, I said, turning to my former apprentice before the Kasari woman could speak, I do not fault you for your heart's choice or even your hasty words. You've lost a good friend, two good friends, as a result. But you have allowed your guilt and regret to colour your command. As your guilt compels you to defend against Natia's ire and understand Gareth's inattention, you've turned anger at her supposed rebellion from a personal slight into a prejudice amongst your riders. Yes, I know that there were other issues that led to the schism, I said, holding up my hand before either could object. That's your concern as commanders, but when you allow such beliefs to take root among your riders, you undermine the morale of all. Both of you are highly intelligent, highly capable young women, among the finest I've ever met. You are both able commanders, and you have both done admirably in growing your wings. But I need their fury directed at the Gavanni, not each other, I lectured. For their sake, and the sake of the men you fly above, you must put aside your personal hurt feelings and find some means to reconcile, I concluded. There was an overlong pause as both girls resisted the urge to speak. Finally, Dara cleared her throat. I will forbid my wing to refer to the Vanadori riders as rebels, she offered reluctantly. Natia's little nostrils flared, but she finally nodded her freckled face. My riders will no longer cast aspersions on Lady Dara's character, she pledged. For my part, she continued quietly, I do regret some of the words I spoke in the Muse Tower that day. It was dishonorable of me, she admitted, and I truly regret I hurt Gareth's feelings that day, Dara said guiltily, and I have missed our friendship. And yours, she added. As have I. Natia sighed. I will pass along your sentiment to the Lord Steward when I get the chance, she promised, though I doubt it will redeem your friendship. He may take some comfort in it. It sounds as if he has quite enough to occupy him without the burden of an old quarrel, Dara suggested, and the rumor is that he and you have... But that's none of my business, she quickly said, shaking her head. We are fast friends, not lovers, Natia admitted, but we both have our duties, and they leave little time for such things. I understand completely, Dara said, rolling her eyes. She was about to launch into a detailed explanation for which I had neither time nor interest, but it was clear that there had been some break in the impasse between the young women. I suggest you finish this conversation over a bottle, my ladies, I said, conjuring one from a huckster and presenting it to them. A Gilmoran red, nothing too fancy, along with a brace of goblets. Am I to understand that the quarrel is at an end, and I can safely go to battle with the confidence that war won't break out between the Muse Towers in the middle of it? I think so, Master. Dara nodded firmly. You have my word, Excellency. Natia agreed. Good, I sighed. I don't know how my dad contended with five daughters and a wife under one roof, but he had taught me a few things about handling such disagreements, confronting each woman with the unvarnished truth and holding her to account, but without assigning fault. Both of them had their share of blame in the argument. But once they were forced to face it in the open, the argument loses its compelling power over them and allows an opportunity for reconciliation. And no, it doesn't always work. The rows between my sisters were legendary, back in Talrion-Burin. Now, if you two can take a few hours to reconcile and formulate a battle plan, I think your riders would appreciate a briefing on Fort Destiny, and I have to get back to watching my trusted officers not screw up this war. I'd like to avoid any surprises. Chapter 17. An unanticipated trip to a tavern. Where the fire burns merry and good ale flows, where conversation churns and good fellows sing, where an evening can find a kiss or turn to blows, Who knows what a night in a tavern might bring? Wilderland's Folk Song, from the collection of Jannik the Riche. We were as prepared as we could be, but it didn't seem as if it could possibly be enough to stand against Shakathet's horde. Telamon was shifting the best of his war magi to Fort Destiny by means of the Alcan Ways, or overland if they had yet to master the spell. Though he was certain the fort was doomed, he was determined to provide an example of the Mage Lord's defiance in its defence. I sat through 3 hours of intense discussion with Mavone, Telamon, Sandoval, and a dozen other senior officers as we tried to plan the best defence of the modest keep that we could manage, and the best means of escape we could, if it was in danger of falling. The number of High Magi and Terra Alon involved ensured that at least some, if not all, of the defenders could, theoretically, retreat through the Alcan Ways, if we needed to. That was a hot discussion. Sandoval and Bendenal took the position that Shakathet's legions were planning some skullduggery, though they could give no evidence, nor even any reasonable possibilities. Mavone and Telamon were convinced that Shakathet was planning on annihilating one castle after another, sapping our strength with every defence against overwhelming odds. While the argument never got out of hand, it was disturbing to see the men who'd handled Gajakatar so handily display such worry about Shakathet. I did my best to not look disturbed, and calmly endorsed Turleman's plan in the absence of better field intelligence. Thankfully, I was distracted from their anxiety by a message from my bard. Jannik wanted to know if I could spare a few hours for something he thought I should spare a few hours on. He had me meet him in a nondescript tavern in Vanador, where he was apparently trying to wash away the mediocrity of the hermits of Corneville with a strong wine and the balm of performing. Yes, while my armies were congregating and preparing to fight for their lives against impossible odds, I popped out for a quick pint at the pub. I found Jannik the Riche sitting against the far wall of the spacious, if humble, establishment. He caught my eye the moment I arrived, glanced briefly at the barman, and then pointedly ignored me, even as he pointed his knees toward a nearby empty seat. I can appreciate subtlety. I'm a wizard. I quietly ordered an ale without the barman recognizing me, and then threaded my way through the growing crowd. It was lunchtime, and slid into the seat Jannik had indicated. It was close enough to him for us to hear each other, but far enough away for us to seem strangers. "Lovely day for a pub crawl, don't you think?" he asked, as he sipped his ale. "Since you are watching and not playing, I'm assuming that you have a higher purpose to this jaunt?" I asked quietly. "Or are you merely spending the day getting drunk?" "I love taverns," he explained, "not just for the drink and the coin, but for the people. You really get an unvarnished look at the human condition in a tavern. Everyone lets their guard down with a drink in their hand, as they bask in the sunshine of hospitality and bathe their brains in alcohol. Well, almost everyone," he corrected, still not looking at me. "That one. He's one to watch," Jannik said, nodding in the direction of a table at the rear of the tavern. A lone man clung to the wall like a moss that had grown there. His brown mantle and hood obscured his face in shadow, his hands hidden under its hem. "He appeared in Vanador about 2 weeks ago," Jannik explained. "His name is Pionin. Keeps to himself, like a monk on pilgrimage." "So?" I asked, prompting Jannik. It wasn't that I doubted my new head of counterintelligence. I just wanted to hear his reasoning. Vanador gets a lot of visitors, even quiet, nondescript visitors who don't move much. "Pionin is no shy rustic," Jannik assured me. "I've had a friend of mine watch his movements. He's been quietly surveying Vanador. The armory, the markets, the walls, the barracks." "So you think he is a spy then?" I frowned. "He's obviously a spy," snorted the bard. "No man comes this far and pursues no business. Indeed, he professes no business," the minstrel insisted. "Three of my friends have engaged him, and they learned nothing about his intentions." "That's as good as admitting he was a spy," Jannik pronounced. "I trust your judgment," I nodded. "So I bring it to my attention, instead of having Sandoval arrest him. Because I wish to know who the spy is working for," Jannik said. "I have my suspicions, but I needed a specialist to confirm them." That startled me, though I tried to conceal it. My only specialty was magic, unless you counted a misplaced sense of smug superiority. You think he's a mage? I asked, troubled. I don't know who Master Pionin is, nor to whom he reports, but I would wager it is not to Mother, nor the Brotherhood, nor our prince's tepid allies. Considering the other possibilities, I thought it best to bring in fresh eyes. Wizard's eyes, he added, giving me a quick glance as he sunk behind his mug. I nodded, understanding his desire. I quietly invoked mage sight, and then began adjusting my perceptions as I gazed at the figure in the shadows. It proved revealing. I appreciated Janik's attention at once. There was something amiss with this newcomer. He was lacking a proper thaumaturgical shroud. All living beings radiate a field the Magi refer to as their shroud. It is a hazy, spectral shell that emanates from their central nervous system or their soul, depending upon your philosophical perspective. With the right application of mage sight, a wizard can see a person's spectral shroud pretty easily and witness its gyrations and evolutions. Ordinarily, a shroud is bright and active, like a cloud on a summer's day. Instead, the field around the man proved to be darker than the shadow he clung to. Indeed, it was clearly necromantic in nature. By Brigger's burning brightness, I think you're right, I murmured. That fellow isn't... Well, he isn't a fellow. He's a fiend, I pronounced. He carries the taint of necromancy about him, though I cannot determine the nature of the spell without a closer examination. I was afraid of that, Janik admitted after a pause. He immediately raised my suspicions. He orders one ale each night and barely touches it. No introverted rustic is going to waste good ale he's paid for, he assured. What coin has he paid in? I asked, curious. I knew my spy would know the answer. The usual Wilderland specie, Janik said, but he got it from a trader and he paid in emeralds. That was about as much as my friends discovered, he added sourly. Pionin has been completely resistant to all attempts to befriend him, and I thought my fellows could charm any man alive, he sighed. Don't be disappointed. He's not exactly alive, I think. He may well be undead, and since his eyes don't glow red or yellow, and he can use coherent speech, that would make him a new kind of undead. If the news shocked the man, he didn't show it. But then he had witnessed horrors in the penumbra that I didn't want to imagine. There is one thing, Janik said casually. His accent is particular. It's a Westland's accent. I nodded sagely, because a good wizard learns how to do that sort of thing when he doesn't have anything better to say. The Westlands were like Gilmora, without the fabulous fertility of the Cottonlands. The region had even fewer pockets of arable land than the Wilderlands did, and the scrubby forests there were unsuitable for most timbering. The Westlands were sparsely populated compared to other parts of Alshar. Their folk had a reputation for cynicism I'd always assumed arose from their marginal position in the duchy. The Westlands were a province once generally passed through on the way to someplace more interesting. When the routes to southern Alshar were closed, they languished. And they had suffered a literal plague for the last few years, one that rose a portion of its victims from the dead. Mavone had surveilled the region for several months on my behalf, and his reports had been ghastly. That makes sense, I finally said. My immediate question is, what is an undead doing lingering in a Vanadori tavern? Waiting, Janik offered. More importantly, listening. This place is popular with a lot of the city watch, the stewardsmen, local tradesmen, and lesser magi. No doubt you could glean a lot of useful information just from attentive listening to gossip. So, what do we want to do about it? I asked the bard. What? You want me to decide? He asked, surprised. You are my new chief of counterintelligence. This is within your domain, I reasoned. If I'm going to be a low and suspicious fellow, I should be getting paid for it, he agreed. Which you are now, I agreed. We'll haggle about the amount later. So tell me, oh, Spymaster, why do you need my help with this? This seems to be under your purview. I thought it was more of a matter of policy, not mere espionage, he countered, which would place it within yours. I don't have enough information to make a policy decision yet, I decided quietly as I studied the situation. But I'm happy to support any action you take. Janik realized he wasn't going to be able to escape his new duty. To his credit, once the decision was made, he committed himself. I suppose the easiest manner in which to learn of a man's history in a tavern is to ask him, he said, rising and straightening his mantle. Pray prepare yourself, but don't approach us unless beckoned. I defer to your experience. But prepare myself for what exactly? I asked, cautiously. To pay for our drinks, among other possibilities. Bide, he directed, and sauntered over to the lone traveller. Before Janik reached Pionin, I'd cast a long ear spell to assist in eavesdropping. Pionin's head gave a slight jerk as I did so, which I assumed indicated a sensitivity to active magic. But there was no other reaction, either from his stony face or his supernatural aura. There was enough casual magic employed around Vanador that he was probably used to such distractions.
You must be that Pionin fellow everyone's talking about, Janik began in an overloud, friendly manner.
The man, or whatever he was, looked up, startled, and his eyes dashed to the door at once.
What? He asked in confusion. Who is talking about me?
There was an element of alarm in his voice.
Oh, you're the topic of conversation in many unusual places, my friend, Janik assured, his voice dropping in volume as he took a seat next to Pionin. And it appears that you are naturally concerned whose ears and tongues are busy with your name. One might conclude that you are not eager for such fame, though you are but newly arrived to the city.
Pionin studied Janik carefully, but he did not display the anxiety or nervousness I'd expect from a living man. Or, perhaps, he was just stoic and level-headed. He also didn't stand up and start slaying everyone in sight, which I considered a good sign.
I am a man of discretion, he finally murmured. Who might you be, to take such an interest in a traveller?
I am a minstrel by trade, known as Janik. Entertaining travellers is what I do. That and listening to gossip, and spreading it, occasionally, he added. I would imagine there are ears that a man of discretion, such as yourself, would prefer his name not fall. The question, Pionin, is just which ears those might be.
Any number of busy buddies,
he said stiffly, and I caught the full Westland's accent in his voice.
My business is my own.
And yet my business is learning other people's business, Janik countered cheerfully. If I knew why you were visiting this shady little town, it might help me decide who needs to know the business of Pionin. The man scowled.
If you insist, I am here bearing a message. I may deliver it only to the one to whom it is intended. And I am awaiting a man who says he can arrange an introduction.
That's a reasonable answer, conceded Janik. Is the recipient a man of high estate or low?
It is likely I might have better contacts, he suggested. Of the very highest,
Pionin said glumly. But I met with a guardsman who says he can introduce me to a squire who might be able to get his attention.
Failing that, I'll try another route.
It must be a terribly important message to require such devious means to deliver it, Janik pointed out.
It must be discreetly delivered,
Pionin sighed. I cannot approach him directly, lest, well, there are other eyes watching, he said in a murmur.
Well, you just can't walk up to the Count and hand him things, agreed Janik, sympathetically.
That's not considered classy in Vanador. People would talk. That startled Pionin further, and he looked even more nervous.
How did you know who I...
You just told me. Calm yourself, man, Janik insisted as he sipped his ale. I would have begun with the king, but he lives elsewhere. And by all accounts, the prince wouldn't visit this land unless he intended to conquer it. And the duke is busy with affairs in the south. So, the count was the man of highest estate that you could, possibly, be trying to deliver your message to. But I would have gone down the mountain of nobility until I discovered which man you meant to see, he reasoned.
Ah, Pionin sighed. Indeed, my message is for his ears alone. Yet he is never in the same place twice, it seems. I hear tailed that he is in his estate at Spellgarden one day, in the Towers the next, and then hear of him in Vanador the same afternoon. I know he is a wizard, but... the man said skeptically. I'm newly come to Vanador myself, Janek agreed conversationally. Never have I seen a stranger folk than these wizards. The most powerful ones can move hundreds of miles in an instant, I've heard. The Count? He is accounted the most potent of them all. I suppose that would make relating a private message difficult. Of course, it's helpful for avoiding determined assassins, he added, in a tone that could be taken for jest or not. Assassins? Perhaps. But it makes my task that much harder, Pionin grumbled. What if I told you that I could help with that task? Janek proposed after a moment's thought. You? The spy asked in disbelief. You know the Count of the Magelar. We're old friends, assured Janek, his smooth tone teasing the ear. Met years ago. I see him around town sometimes. I might be able to arrange an introduction, he offered. My lord, while I appreciate your kind offer, Pionin said sarcastically, and I would be much in your debt for such an introduction, I find myself skeptical. Well, if you would be in my debt, then I can hardly pass up the occasion to do so, can I? Janek asked. Men? Menelan, over here, my friend, he called to me, beckoning as if we were village mates after work. I'll admit it wasn't the summons I had been expecting. I had been prepared for a war cry or accusation, and I had arranged several spells designed for protection and carnage. But it was a simple summons, and it deserved a simple response. Considering the number of tavern patrons who might have gotten hurt in an altercation, I was pleased. I nodded and then dragged a chair to the corner with them. Good afternoon, gentlemen, I said, as I settled into the seat and raised my mug. Pionin, this is Baron Menelan the Spellmonger, Count Palatine of the Magelaw, head of the Arcane Orders, and all of that. Min, this is Pionin, an emissary and spy from one of the Nemavorti, who purports to bear a message from his master. That shocked the former Westlandsman. What did you say? He stammered. You wanted to meet the Count of the Magelaw, reasoned Janek. He just happened to be here. I just introduced you, placing you in my debt, he concluded. You aren't the Count of the Magelaw, the spy accused, as he looked me up and down. Admittedly, I wasn't wearing either court finery, wizard's robes, or battle armor. When one is meeting one's new chief of counterintelligence in public, a more subtle look is required. I was dressed as well as a prosperous artisan or a busy burgher, but I wasn't even bearing my hat and staff. I am indeed Count Menelan, I said quietly, and I'm quite curious why a Nemavort would send a message to me that didn't come wrapped in deathly peril. Who said... Well, that is, he said, trying to collect his thoughts. You don't look like a count. A count is a lordly man, and he wouldn't be hanging out in common taverns, he assured me. You lot are robbers, aren't you? He asked scornfully. Oh, he's quite a common fellow, once you get to know him, Janek observed, and I'm quite too lazy to be a robber. I think it's best you establish your credentials, my friend. As you wish, I sighed, and pulled the megalith into sight. It immediately began hovering behind my right shoulder, as everyone in the room stopped talking and stared. Oh, this is going to get complicated if, Janek said, looking around at them all. Can you lovely people spare the Count a moment with our friend? He asked the crowd politely. I'm certain he'll be treating you to a round afterwards, he added, glancing at me impishly. Most tried to linger until he gave them a pointed stare that seemed to propel every single one of them out of the tavern. You too, Goodman, he added to the barman, who just realized that the Count of his realm was patronizing his establishment. He looked back and forth for a moment, then nodded and followed the others. I was impressed. In 2 minutes, Janek had cleared the place without magic. Now, he continued as the door closed, I believe I've established that this is, indeed, Menelan, the Count of the Magelaw. That means you are in my debt, Goodman, and I take my debts very seriously. On whose behalf do you bear this message? He demanded quietly.
A slim, elegant, but terribly menacing dagger appeared from somewhere and found a home in his nimble fingers. I'm assuming it's Karakush, the sorcerer. A secret message isn't Shakathet's style. But if it isn't Karakush, I want to know who. Pionin looked nervously from me to Janik and back, but if he was afraid of the sudden flash of steel, he didn't show it. He swallowed and sighed.
Aye, it's that rascal, he said gloomily. Karakush. He wanted one of us who could blend into the background, so to speak, to bring a very discreet message north to the spellmonger.
Why would a Nemavort want to send me a message that wasn't sent by an army? I asked shrewdly. And why would I trust it if he did?
I cannot answer for him, Pionin said distastefully. I know not his reasoning nor his strategy. All I know is that I was a chandler in the Westlands when his thugs came to my village with their filthy orders. My whole family was rounded up and marched off to some godforsaken tower in the wild. We were guarded by the undead, he said horrifically. They forced us to work. Simple things, but requiring great labor. It was like they were stealing us, he said, his eyes narrowing. I tried my best to keep my family safe and together, but it was hard, he said sorrowfully. But one day, one of the Alka Alon, only a tall, gangly one in armor, came and asked us a bunch of questions about where we'd traveled, of all things. Madness, considering the conditions they were keeping us under. I told them I'd been as far as Verone before, so they chose me to be the messenger.
Just because you knew the way to Verone? Janik asked, confused.
They needed someone who could move about without attracting attention, and who knew the customs, he explained. I spent a year in Verone as an exchange apprentice, so I knew the town, and they decided I was intelligent enough to make it as far as this Vanador place and get a message to the spellmonger.
We'll accept that tale for the moment, I said evenly. You have accomplished your task. Now deliver your message, I demanded.
Karakush says that if you wish to defeat Shakathet in battle, the simplest means to do so is to remove his ablest commanders. I have their names and positions memorized if you would like me to recite them, he promised. Some are more vulnerable than others, but their subordinates are incompetent.
Why would Karakush wish to aid me against Shakathet? I asked curiously. They are both Nemavorti, sworn to slay me. I suppose Karakush would rather betray his fellow than allow him victory, Janik proposed. In doing so, he tests you, Minilin, your intelligence, your resolve, and your strategic sense. All very useful things to know about an enemy, he pointed out.
Yet if I ignore this intelligence, I observed, then that tells him something about me too, I sighed. There is more, Pionin said. Pray hear me out, my lords, as my commission is not fulfilled until you do so, he explained.
Janik and I nodded for him to continue.
Shakathet has many secret sorceries planned for the battle, but Karakush is skeptical of them. Nonetheless, he says to tell you to be prepared for one that may doom you if it takes you unawares.
He proceeded to relate our foe's possession of the mighty weapon and gave us some hints on how to counter it. It was an impressive deployment, and one that seemed too specific and too detailed to be untruthful. Pionin certainly believed it. He assured us he'd seen such things in the work camps, being tested before being sent to war. If Karakush's suggestion to counter it worked, it could spare thousands of lives. If it didn't, well, I would have to pay the third Nemavord to come against me a visit.
Am I expected to return a message? I asked the spy. If my lord would like, I will bear one south to his holdings, Pionin assured.
Not until you explain how you are undead, yet can keep your mind, I insisted.
Undead? Pionin asked, surprised. Nay, I am not, my lord, at least not yet. To ensure my compliance with Master Karakush's mission, he set upon me some sorcery that he promised would strip me of my soul and mind at once, and was entangled with a similar spell on my daughter, he explained, my last surviving daughter. As it is, we both dwell on the threshold of death, he said sadly. Our only hope of relief
is the successful conclusion of my mission, and for that I have only the Nemavort's word. That's ghastly, Janik said sympathetically. But if you're not undead, why didn't you touch your ale? The bard asked, confused. Because this well is as thick and chewy as an oak tree, compared to what we drink in the Westlands. Ishi's tits, have the Wilderlands never heard of properly hopping your brews? He asked, staring at his mug of dark ale, offended. Pionin proved a valuable window into the world of our third Nemavort adversary. Janik had him tell his story from the beginning, in detail, and asked several pointed questions along the way. I could tell he was learning far more from the cursed Chandler than he let on. He also had the man recite everything he could about Shakathet's officers, the ones Karakush thought were vulnerable, and to what. If Gajakatar had been impetuous, and Shakathet determined, Karakush seemed to specialize in treachery. We spoke until early evening, when Pionin's store of gossip seemed to play out. I quietly summoned a squad of guardsmen, led by Gareth himself, to lead the spy to secure quarters for the night. He went peacefully enough. He might have been sneaky, but Pionin was not a man of violence. The poor Chandler was just trying to save his last daughter's life, after all. As long as he was free to return to the Westlands, he assured us, his child would be spared the hideous fate Karakush promised. I don't know how much I'd trust a murdering Nemavort, Janik admitted, once Pionin was quietly escorted away. I instructed Gareth to find him safe but secure quarters in the crevice, the crude but effective defense we'd constructed in the darkest reaches of the overhang. He seems to put a lot of faith in the evil bastard keeping his word. What choice does he have? I shrugged. When it is your last surviving daughter, you're really willing to believe anything. Perhaps it was just as well I never wed, much less bred, Janik said with a sigh. That would have seen me at the Fair Vale when it was plundered, dead, among other depressing prospects. Children are lever against a man, I agreed, as our adversary has determined. But he wasn't lying, according to the truth-tell I cast. Not one word. Oh, I could tell that without magic, Janik dismissed. I've heard more lies in taverns than a pretty maiden. The Chandler is an honest man in a dire position, he concluded, yet I gleaned quite a bit from his tale. Such as, I asked, conjuring a bottle of wine and two glasses from a hockster, a vintage far advanced from the local wine served here. Oh, I do love magic, chuckled the bard as he poured the wine. Among the most important lessons I learned was that Karakush is a treacherous foe with a penchant for betrayal, he informed me. Instead of concentrating his forces at some forbidding fortress, as Shakathet and Gajakatar did, he has spread his strength at a number of lesser installations. Our friend, the Chandler, mentioned the ones in the Westlands, but from what he said, Karakush has little pockets of evil all over the West. The Westlands, the Land of Scars, the Wilderlands, even Northern Gilmora. Northern Gilmora? I asked, surprised. How did you discover that? An inference based on the number of days it took to get a message to poor Pionin's handler, explained Janik. Just a guess, but I'm near certain that he has a base in northern Gilmora. But what is more disturbing than his proximity is the manner of his servants. Karakush seems to have a fetish for magic, he suggested. Well, magic and subterfuge, but likely he's partial to magic more. He's hoping you expend your strength on Shakathet and will be weak and vulnerable after you barely defeat him. It's an eminently reasonable strategy, he added. I can't argue that, I sighed. Putting 10,000, 15,000 men in the field against more than 60,000 is going to be a challenge. Yet you managed to stop Gajakatar's force with less, reminded Janik as he poured my cup full. That must have been instructive for our foe. No doubt, I agreed, considering my position from the perspective of my foe. And Karakush seems fairly confident I will prevail against Shakathet, yet not so much that he isn't unwilling to fix the game beforehand. That's assuming you'll act on his information, Janik pointed out. How can I not? I pleaded, throwing my hands wide. With a great deal of discipline, counseled Janik sagely. This intelligence is a gift, Menelin. Not all gifts are beneficial. This one seems too good to be true, which it is. There is a trap in this information, my lord, he insisted.
A trap? I asked, unsurprised.
I'd come to the conclusion myself. I just wanted to hear Janik's reasoning. Of course, my lord, Janik assured solemnly as he sipped his wine. It would be embarrassing to take such information at face value, and considering what we have learned about our foe, accepting such a gift without understanding its nature would be unfortunate. Pionin, for all of his candor, could not hide the fact that Karakush does not indeed wish us to triumph against Shakothet. He would be content if we would merely prevail and remove Shakothet as a rival in Korbal's court. We can expect that the most valuable information provided is, indeed, just slightly inaccurate, he said, choosing his words wisely. Thus ensuring we expend strength unnecessarily, I concluded. Just so, Janik confirmed as he swallowed. Karakush's plot involves you going against Shakothet hard and taking his advice about his vulnerable subordinates, which means that several of these targets, he said, looking for the right word, are indeed traps to sap our strength and tax our resolve. Karakush's plan involves you being unable to defend against a band of enthusiastic Kasari youths, much less a sinister campaign waged in the shadows. Not that his intelligence is unwelcome, he advised, but depending upon it has the potential to see to our doom, even as we prevail against Shakothet. So what do we do? I asked my new chief of counterintelligence. We use what we have as best we can, and be aware of what mischief can arise if we follow his instruction to the letter. These commanders are vulnerable, he declared, but listening to Karakush's unvarnished advice will ultimately lead to ruin, he predicted. Take the top three targets he names, he suggested. Will their removal aid us? Of course. Will throwing hundreds of troops at them change the equation? He proposed. I think not. The key, my lord, he explained conspiratorially, is to skim the cream of this report without dipping into the unfortunately tainted milk. Perhaps something a little more specific? I prompted, as Janik sketched a broad and vague program in response. Take the intelligence and use it as you will, but without falling into the trap, he explained as he poured another cup of wine. You know the important players. Contend with them in a manner that will reduce the damage that Karakush so clearly intends, he proposed. I can do no less, I agreed. I will have to take this up with Terlaman and Mavone, I promised. No doubt they will have some perspectives on this matter. They would not be the officers they are if they did not have some important insights, agreed Janik, slurring his words just a bit. Though I had but scant acquaintance of the man, I guessed that his drunkenness was affected. I hoped. Agreed, I said, swallowing the last dregs in my cup. If they cannot see the traps implicit in this communication, then I have the wrong men in the wrong positions. That seems a stark assessment, and a dire consequence, if you are wrong, my lord, Janik said sympathetically. In my opinion, he added hastily. Perhaps, I shrugged, but they are the best men for the jobs, and they were contracted before the conspiracies of the Nemavorti were apparent. If I didn't think that they could conspire against the gods themselves, I would have found better, I promised. Minolan, I do hope you are right, Janik said, after considering his wine cup overmuch. I have grown used to placing my trust and optimism in the scantest of hopes and the wildest of dreams. I'd almost be disappointed if those mad hopes didn't bear fruit once in a while. Now that I've returned to what's left of the Wilderlands, I find it in largely capable, all right, perhaps adequate would be a better term, hands, perhaps for the first time in history. You seem to have a low opinion of the reign of the Wilderlords, I pointed out. Oh, most of them were all right, he conceded, historically speaking. But they were never united or determined to do anything but survive and improve their holdings a bit. Their little wars and nasty little feuds kept them from ever making anything of themselves, or this grand land we inhabit. Those who gained power were incompetent. Those who were competent found themselves lured south. It was up to the Rish to keep things orderly, he said nostalgically, as you continue to do, even in the face of such abject adequacy. I said drolly, what is your opinion of Count Markadine? I asked, suddenly curious. He's one of the better Wilderlords, admitted the bard after a moment's contemplation. He's competent, at least so far, and he's been given more power than any Wilderlord in our age. If he can survive his own Nemovort, he may make something out of this Wilderlore of his. And you've no desire to join him and make your mark in a court more familiar to you? I asked. Wilderlords are boring. Janik decided, wizards are interesting, and I've always been partial to the north, as charming as the southern Wilderlands are. I'll continue sullying my reputation here, if you don't mind. When it runs out, then I'll flee to the Wilderlore. He glanced up and saw the nervous barman lingering by the door. It's all right, he called to the man, just a bit of discussion between friends, which required the use of the city guard. He conceded. All done now. Get back to business, he suggested, as the barman returned to his counter, a long line of intrigued patrons behind him. Thank you for your patience, my friends, I added in my best authoritative voice. And your discretion, I added. Indeed, His Excellency is so grateful for both, Janik continued, that he's asked that I sing a few songs, while he buys the ale for the rest of the night. That produced a robust cheer that shook the room. Ishi's tits, I whispered to the bard as the barman began to pour for his happy customers. You do know I'm likely going into battle tomorrow. And taking your purse with you, Janik agreed, whereas you're both here right now. By the time this night is over, no one will remember why the spellmonger popped in. They'll just remember the free drinks and delightful entertainment, he explained. You can slip out just after you pay the bill, he added, as he produced his guitar. It made sense, even if it seemed both woefully opportunistic of Janik and foolish of me to indulge in drink on the eve of a battle. Besides, it was very good ale, which was neither thick nor chewy, and only vaguely like drinking an oak tree. Chapter 18. The Storm Breaks. Who rises to defend us during bleakest night? Who stands boldly defiant and never shirks a fight? Who leads the warriors fearlessly into battle's heat? Caswallon the Fox has never tasted defeat. From The Ballad of Caswallon the Fox, written and performed by Caswallon the Fox, from the collection of Janik the Riche. I watched the slow progress of Shakathet's vanguard as it crawled south across the landscape toward Fort Destiny, as demonstrated by the models on the grand diorama Azar kept at Megalyn with toy-like markers Lancer Bune had created for the device. Behind it was another cluster, and another. Each had the symbols for Fellhound cavalry, goblin infantry, trolls and artillery. Shakathet would be able to begin his siege as soon as his forces arrived. Despite the slow speed of each unit, that would be sometime in the night, it was predicted. Of course, it wasn't Shakathet who was leading the vanguard. Thanks to Pionin's report and Mavone's spies, he was able to identify the captain as one Astellathal, an apparently haughty but proficient enshadowed commander. About half of the unit's commanders were known now, and Mavone had begun assembling dossiers on them. They weren't particularly thick. Most of our intelligence on the enshadowed came from the Terra alone, and there wasn't much. Haughty but proficient was one of the more comprehensive reports we'd gotten. While that was disappointing, I didn't think Pionin's report would matter much to our grand strategy. Even if we did trust it, we just were not in a position to take advantage of it. We didn't have any spies or assassins actually in the enemy camp, and we didn't have the forces to throw sorties at them along the way. Tricky one, this Shakathet, a voice came from behind me. I recognized it at once. Slagger, god of games. He'd appeared to me before on the eve of battle to advise me about strategy. He's far more methodical than Gadja Katar, regrettably. This departure from normal troop formation has me concerned, I announced, welcoming a divine perspective on the battle.
It should, Slagur agreed,
but not for the reasons you think. Few commanders would have the courage to divide their forces in front of the enemy, he pointed out.
So he's confident, I reasoned. Perhaps overconfident, I asked, hopefully.
Not facing the numbers he is, Slagur chuckled. He has you dramatically outnumbered.
We have Iltadin steel weapons, I pointed out, and too few men to use them, Slagur replied, as he surveyed the diorama.
We have magic, I observed, gesturing toward the megalith where it was floating nearby.
As do they, Slagur countered.
Both enshadowed sorcery and the necromancy the Nemovorti employ, and the garden variety goblin shamanism fueled by the power of Irionite.
We have giant hawks, I said defensively, and they have giant wyverns, and dragons if they use them, the god of game said, shaking his head.
Will they? I asked suddenly, hoping to get Slagur to gift me with a morsel of intelligence.
Who knows? The god shrugged unhelpfully. It's a possibility. One of many, and one that should not be ignored.
But considering how poorly the dragons have fared in open battle, that might not be Shakathet's impulse.
Of course, they are particularly good at trashing castles, I sighed, as I glanced at the models of various fortresses strewn across the recreated landscape of the diorama.
Fort Destiny was one, at the south of the map, the one every enemy unit was marching toward. But to the east were the castles of Ironhill, Forgemont, and Megalyn, among others. A single dragon, properly employed, could have ravaged each of them in one day.
Thankfully, you don't have that many castles, Slagur noted.
Yes, I feel uncommonly lucky about that, I said sarcastically.
If castles attract dragons, then it's probably just as well you don't have many, he countered.
Was there a purpose behind this divine visit beyond criticism? I asked pointedly.
I'm trying to fight a war here.
You're trying to win a war, Slagur corrected, as he adjusted one of the enemy unit's model.
You'll do that partially by fighting, but I don't think that will be what decides it, he pronounced.
As far as advice, emulate your Kasari subjects.
Be prepared, he counseled.
For what? I demanded.
I'm as prepared for this as I can get.
For the unexpected, he said, as he disappeared. A moment later, Mavone entered the room, striding through the space Slagur had just vacated without realizing it.
What is it? I asked him when I saw the look on his face.
We're hopelessly outnumbered, he said, as he came to study the diorama.
That was just pointed out to me, I muttered.
I'm concerned about this novel approach to advancing his column, he added nervously, as he gestured to the long line of models heading toward Fort Destiny.
As am I agreed.
He'll hit Fort Destiny with wave after wave, until he grinds it from existence, I predicted.
Destiny is too far away from the other strongholds for them to offer much relief, Mavone said, his lips pursed in thought.
Yet their units are moving along closely enough to lend aid to each other if we strike against them, I added.
Tarleman wants to shift the bulk of the magic core to Fort Destiny to shore them up, Mavone informed me.
We just had a discussion about the matter, he said, choosing his words diplomatically.
I could tell how that discussion went. I tried not to wince. It's never good when your two best commanders are at odds.
If we do, I pointed out, hopefully, we could conceivably eliminate the first unit before the second arrives,
but not the second before the third arrives,
Mavone countered, and we would be leaving our other fortresses relatively undefended.
Which was the case you made to Tarleman, I realized.
Mavone, this isn't an attempt to get me to change his policy, is it? I asked.
That sort of thing wasn't Mavone's style, but he was a spy.
No, he dismissed, when he realized what I was suggesting.
Tarleman is in command. I'm just concerned, is all. I can't shake the feeling that this is a ruse.
Well, they could speed past Destiny and battle right toward Verone, I suggested, but we'd be aware of that and take measures long before they arrived.
Nor could they strike at Spellgate again without our notice, he agreed, staring at the map.
I don't know what Shakathet is planning, but
I have it on highest authority that this Nemovort is strategically gifted, I said.
chewing my lip a bit in thought. Even tricky.
Yes, that's helpful,
Mavone said after a moment's hesitation. And his captain in the vanguard is proficient and haughty, I added. Useful if you're playing dice against a gentleman, but unlikely to be of use in battle, he sighed. What does Sandoval think? I asked. My constable was in charge of the few thousand men in our army, even as Turlamon commanded them. He just wants the battle to start, so that it can be over, Mavone explained. He doesn't much care where, he just wants to get home to his new wife. So he has no idea either, I sighed. Not an inkling, Mavone agreed, nodding grimly. All afternoon the reports came in detailing the position of each of the 8 big units. They were not all equal. The largest was a full 10,000, the smallest a mere 6,000, but they kept moving south like a new foul river springing forth from the hills. It was exhausting to watch the diorama, listen to dispatches, and wallow in the anxiety and anticipation. Turlamon did order about half of the Magic Corps to travel to Fort Destiny that day, in order to give Captain Astellathal and his vanguard a proper welcome. By the time luncheon was brought in from the mess, I felt like I'd hiked all day long. It was unusual for me to dine without being attended by Ruderal, but my apprentice was back in Gilmora with Atipol, arranging a few things on my behalf. I made do with one of Bendanal's squires who was eager to claim he'd served the spellmonger himself. The fare was basic but hearty, the kind of decent meal you get before the gates are locked and the enemy is at the door. But it was a damn sight better than what we'd gotten in Faerys, and Mavone and I spent the afternoon discussing the difference. By nightfall, Astellathal's unit had come within 2 miles of Fort Destiny. The next unit, which was commanded by a Gavanni, who was one of the few goblins in charge of the march, lagged behind them by half a day. Come morning, everyone knew, the siege would begin in earnest, and the day after that, the little castle would get pounded by a second army arriving. At least, that's what we thought. Most of the senior staff at Megalyn had just paused to listen to the War Brothers' version of Vespers at nightfall, from the mess hall balcony overlooking the courtyard, and as the sun swiftly sank behind the horizon, and the throaty chant of the Destroyer's Blessing wished us a vigilant night, Mavone entered the room, breathless.
I was right, he burst out. Gods damn me, I was right.
What is it?
Brendanal, our host, insisted.
I just got word from 3 separate sources,
Mavone explained. Each one of those units, save the Vanguard, has broken from their southward path and begun to cut across country, all at the same time. In moments, a dozen of us had piled into the diorama room where a brace of aides was pushing the models into their newly reported positions with long sticks. A brief glance at the map demonstrated Mavone's concerns in an instant.
The second unit is moving fast toward Iron Hill, Sandoval reported, reading from a dispatch. They've sent out their fell hounds in advance and are marching at double speed, outpacing their artillery.
Third unit is headed for Forgemont, if this is to be believed, one of the garrison commanders announced, discouraged, as he studied the models.
Fourth is headed... Well, it's coming for us, Brendanal said darkly. He immediately closed his eyes, no doubt issuing orders to his subordinates mind to mind. I've alerted Azar in the field, he said a moment later.
Oh, he'll love that,
muttered Mavone. Where are units 5 and 6 headed?
Indeterminate, my lord, the aide reported regretfully. Perhaps Yelin or the Wild Water Settlements?
They may well be headed to guard the fords and the road, to keep reinforcements from reaching us from Vanador, suggested Bendanal.
They're attacking us all at once, I realized. Each of those units will overmatch the garrison at the castle it invests, I predicted gloomily, thus preventing any of them from assisting the others.
And leaving our reserves at the mercy of their raiders, agreed Sandoval grimly. They weren't going to hit Fort Destiny to overwhelm it, just to hold it and misdirect our attention.
How long do we have? Turlamon asked quietly, as he entered the room and strode to his place along the diorama.
Hours,
Mavone informed him. At this pace, Forgemont will be reached by dawn, Ironhill by noon, Megalyn by this time tomorrow. It was a dire prediction, but that is what the great diorama told us all. Each of Shacketh's great units, little armies in their own right, had a designated task, a specific foe they were to face. While their immediate objectives might be in doubt, Shakathet had turned his mighty river of evil into a splash that covered half of my realm in a day. That's what he meant by tricky, I muttered to myself as I watched the approaching hordes. Do we have a contingency for this, my lord? Pendennal asked, when we had hastily reconvened in the council chamber. No, I admitted. Yes, Telamon said at the exact same moment. We glanced at each other. We do? I asked, curious. It was always a possibility, Telamon insisted, one of many that I had contingencies for. I just did not expect Shakathet to deploy his troops so suddenly or efficiently, he confessed. I anticipated having more warning. So what is your plan? Urged Sandoval. If anyone expected Telamon to fumble for excuses or scramble for answers, they were disappointed. We get besieged, he began. We protect our reserves beyond the river and determine the weakest besieging force. Focusing our operations on that one, we will draw off relief from the other castles as they send reinforcements. By rapidly shifting our attacks between sieges, we can siphon off a number of troops just in transit. With consistent raiding and interference, we should be able to lift each siege within a few weeks. Our castles merely need to hold out. He said the whole thing with confidence and reason, as if the course of action was plain for everyone to see. I'm sure the junior officers were heartened by that confidence. Some of Telamon's peers weren't so sanguine. That's a hell of a plan, Sandoval said glumly. It's not particularly complicated, Telamon pointed out. We must just outlast them, outfight them, and take advantage of their weaknesses. If our foe wants to divide his forces for us, then we should use that against them. Agreed, Pendennal said, his brow furrowed. But that leaves many things to chance. We are now dependent on each commander to fight a siege with virtually no hope of reinforcements. We did it at Beauval Vale, reminded Mavone. I wasn't at Beauval Vale, Sandoval said sourly. If I'd been there, I would have told you how bloody hopeless it was. It's not hopeless, Telamon insisted. It's just difficult. But in many ways it plays to our greatest strength, our castles. The Alca-Alon and the Enshadowed are not adept at sieges. Each one is an opportunity for us to grind their forces down to a nub. That's awfully optimistic, Mavone observed. It's what we have to do to win with what we have to work with, Telamon said, each word falling like a brick. If you've a better plan, I would enjoy hearing it. Of course, we went with Telamon's plan. There wasn't really a better alternative. As dispatches and reports arrived in the night, adjusting the precise positions of our enemy, more went out ordering our various field and garrison units into action. Azar and Tyndall took their cavalry units deep into the field, away from the direct path of any of the armies, and waited to pick off stragglers. But it wasn't enough to deter their advance toward our fortresses. The magic corps split up and was sent by the ways to the threatened castles. What few infantry units were in the field were directed to make haste and find shelter against the storm of Gavani who approached. Those who could not make it to their destinations were rerouted to what we hoped were secure locations. Sometimes that meant sending a skyrider to intercept them, but Sandoval assured me, just before dawn, that all of his men were accounted for. So, where do you want me? I asked Telamon that morning, as the servants brought in breakfast. He considered. Everywhere. Nowhere. In the last war, your reputation worked for us more than your appearance, he said uncritically. Indeed, more than your actual performance on the battlefield. Having the enigmatic spellmonger ready to appear out of nowhere and blast everyone in sight is terribly demoralizing. I'm not enigmatic, I complained, as I poured cream over my porridge. I'm really rather straightforward. You are enigmatic to our foes, Telamon advised me as he buttered a biscuit. Indeed, you are a figure of legend. Mavone is certain of it. You are as personally terrifying to the Gavani as Korbal is to our men. We face more than Gavani in this war, I reminded him, and to be fair, I'm prettier than Korbal. Do you think the Enshadowed in Shakathet's army do not fear you? He asked. You fought Korbel and Shurul to a standstill and crippled them both. You continuously employ novel means of magic and warfare, and you have been victorious far more than not. So should I be selling souvenirs? I asked mockingly. Or do you actually want me in the field? I need some direction here, Tal, I complained. The truth is, Minilin, I think our best plan involves keeping you on the move, using your power and reputation to make it appear as if you are everywhere at once. Surprise me, and them, he said, with a meaningful nod of his head. I could add you to a dozen different fronts to try to affect the overall strategy, but I really think keeping our foe off balance with the element of surprise and the power of the spellmonger is our best strategy under the circumstances. I considered the proposed mission for several thoughtful moments. So, you basically want me to wander around and mess stuff up, I summarized. If I need you in one particular place, I'll ask, he assured me. The truth is, there is just too much going on for me to assign you anywhere. So, go everywhere. Pick a spot, show up, help out, dazzle them with your brilliance and move on, he recommended. There's no accounting for how off-balance that will keep Shacothet. I can do that, I conceded. In fact, after the dreary winter war with Gadjah-Katar, in which I'd done precious little, it sounded almost like fun, in a war magi sort of way. I can pick a team? I asked, hopefully. As long as they're not needed elsewhere, he agreed. Keep it small and powerful. You're a relatively decent field commander, he conceded, but I don't want to lose one of my best strategic assets on the field because you were too busy to watch your back. I think I know a few fellows who'd enjoy this sort of thing, I nodded, stroking my beard. It was odd, being referred to as a strategic asset, but it told me a lot about how Turlaman was approaching this war. You're going to pick Caswallon, aren't you? He guessed. Please, take him. He's perfect. And annoying to command, he added. He's also expendable. I'll speak to him, I assured, with a chuckle. When do you want me to deploy? As soon as you're done with your porridge, he said, as a page brought him a sheaf of new dispatches. Now, leave me alone. I'm going to be busy. The unexpected mission Turlaman gave me provided me an opportunity to exercise some magical muscles that had been cramped up for far too long. Don't mistake me. I am not fond of war, but I'd spent most of my adult life involved in wars, from Faris to this very day. My professional pride and experience made standing around, making policy decisions, while other men took the field, an exercise in frustration. There comes a point in planning where you have to start seeing the plan in action, or you lose heart or start making mistakes. Turlaman's mission was a gift. I appreciated how he'd employed me during last winter's war, but I was at my best on the field, I thought. I didn't wait to finish my porridge. I started speaking mind to mind with the war magi I wanted to fight with me. Caswallon was at the top of my list, of course, because he performs best when he's able to be glorious under the nose of someone important. But then I had to ask around a bit, as many of my first choices were otherwise deployed. Azar was commanding the Megalini cavalry in the field, alongside Tyndall's Northern Knights. Taran was busy at Vanador's Bulyuterion, crafting new enchantments. I didn't want to interrupt him. Wenik was leading his Pearwood's tribesmen at Forgemont, and I didn't want to deprive them of his strong leadership at such an important time. Mavone and Sandy were busy, of course. But Astaral happened to be visiting his intended bride at her sequestration and grudgingly admitted that my mission had a certain appeal. Then he recommended a Terra Alon warrior named Timoniel, who was eager for action. A fellow who'd been studying Humani war magic since he came to Vanador and was already gathering a reputation. I approved. A few moments later, Landric assured me that he could be spared from commanding a unit of reserves to indulge in some field experience with the spellmonger. The sixth member of the team was someone I'd been meaning to evaluate for some time, but hadn't had a good opportunity until now. A young war mage named Boroso. He was one of the young wizards who had fled Sevendor for Vanador when I'd been exiled. He'd been a recruit for the attack on Olam Saheri, and he developed a good professional reputation since then, and a reputation for strong opinions. Despite Boroso's name, he wasn't Remiran, but hailed from the coastlands of Castor. Boroso was one of the unofficial leaders of the self-exiled war magi.
He'd haunted the Staff and Sword Tavern back in Sevendor for a few months, then hitched a ride with a high mage to Castabriel for a while. When the Duke's men made the taverns around the Arcane Order unfriendly, he relocated to Vanador, where Terlaman recruited him as a combat mage. By all accounts, he'd fought well in the Vanadori Magic Corps all last winter, and had earned a Witchstone as a result. As expected, he was passing eager to fight by my side, but also had the kind of cocky, confident air that the war magi cultivate in general, though instead of a smug smirk, he allowed his jutting jaw to communicate his innate feeling of superiority. He had enough sense not to be obsequious, after assuring me what an honour it was to be chosen. As soon as he arrived at Megalyn, by the ways, mid-morning, and he got the nominal ass-kissing over with, he was all business. He was a well-muscled man with a broad face and a chin sharp enough to plough a furrow. He had recently constructed a new battle staff at the Bouleuterion, and he had a well-made helm and armour, one of the new styles of close-fitting plate of Iltadine steel that the Dradrian were developing for war magi. Astaroth and his friend Tamoniel arrived at Megalyn that afternoon, followed by Landric and Caswallon at dusk, on horseback. Despite having Urianite and a knowledge of the ways, I think Caswallon thought he looked more dashing arriving that way. The rest of us were already discussing the nature of the mission and several possible targets. We kept checking the situation as it unfolded in Terlaman's war chamber and adjusted our plans accordingly. It was an intelligent, reasonable discussion among professionals after introductions were made and a few drinks passed our lips. I watched how my new squadron reacted to the news with great interest. Tamoniel seemed more willing to listen than to speak, but proved a witty fellow possessed of a great curiosity about Humani warfare, as well as our customs. He'd been born around the time of the conquest, 400 years before, and had developed the keen interest in his fascinating ephemeral neighbours. He'd been studying our war magic style for more than a year now, with excellent results. He'd also had kin who'd been slain in a refuge near the Mindens, so he was committed to the war effort. It was telling that Tamoniel had developed a casual air when around Humani, the same sort of manner as the emissaries, the Lastian and Onranian, had. I was even more curious about Boroso. Astaroth and I asked him about his history and his preferences in battle, as well as his capacity for tactical thinking. He proved to have an intelligent understanding of the business. Astaroth invited his opinion on how to defend Forgemont, and that sparked a lively discussion on defensive war magics, which quickly devolved into the technical aspects, but also lived up to his reputation as a war mage. He was well-educated and experienced. But then Caswallon arrived, and suddenly we weren't merely reviewing our operational strategy, we were on a grand adventure of mythic proportions, whether we wanted to be or not. "My noble lords," Caswallon the Fox began, after introductions were done, "it is my dearest honour to shed blood with you this day. May our blades be wet with the viscera of our foes. Such a mighty struggle against such dire odds will surely challenge the limits of valour," he declared, loudly and with great enthusiasm. Boroso and Tamoniel exchanged glances, having just met the man. I smiled indulgently and gave the proper response. "It is we who are fortunate to fight beside one so bold, Caswallon," I assured him. "The day ahead will be hard, and the night that follows filled with blood and ash. I do hope the fox is prepared," I challenged him. The flattery was like offering an apple to a starving horse. He almost took off my fingers. "Prepared?" he asked, a confident look in his eye. "Aye, my count, I have searched for the most deadly spells from my library and sacked my armory for the perfect panoply for such a mission. I have honed my body with especial herbs and tinctures, training for hours against such a day as this," he said with certainty. "Aye, no man alive is more prepared for the brutal task ahead than Caswallon the Fox." "That's good to know," said Boroso, uncertainly. "A simple yes would have sufficed," Landric muttered, shaking his head and rolling his eyes expressively. "My sword thirsts for the blood of our foes," Caswallon said, ignoring the former censor's jibe. "I have pledged to defend this land with the last drop of mine. The dark foe will not prevail while there is breath in my body and strength in my arm," he declared. "Really?" Tamoniel asked, skeptically amused.
Of a certainty, my terror alone, friend, Caswallon boomed. The clash of steel and the cries of the vanquished will soon echo throughout this rustic realm. I will permit no evil to befoul its sacred soil. Oh, come now, Astaral teased. Perhaps just a bit of evil? Canoodling with his beloved had given him a wicked disposition, I saw. It keeps things interesting. Nay, Caswallon insisted seriously. No dark force will persist here. Not while Caswallon is on duty. We will dart about and slay with such sudden ferocity that even the most twisted malevolence will shrink from my fury. Caswallon, why don't you check in with the paymaster and add yourself to the rolls? Perhaps have a morsel to refresh yourself before we depart, I advised. He's up the stairs and across the gallery, first chamber on the left. As you wish, my count, he said, and trotted away. Ishi's tits, is that man as enthusiastic as he appears? Barroso asked in disbelief. Oh, he's just warming up, Astaral said smugly. He'll get much better after a few slayings. I found him quite interesting, confessed Timoniel. He seems an intriguing specimen of your warrior class. He's an intriguing specimen of pompous ass, corrected Landric. He's a good war mage, certainly, but he's insufferable. And he's like that all the time. It's no act. He really believes it, he said, shaking his head. He really is good at this sort of special operation, I assured them. He was with me during the emancipation, and he did well. He fights like a demon. And yes, he keeps talking like that while he's fighting. The entire time. He thinks it cheers those around him to greater feats of glory, or something like that. And it discourages his foes, whether they can understand him or not. You get used to it, I shrugged. Caswallon suffers from an abundance of enthusiasm, a compulsion to action, Astaral explained, mostly toward Timoniel, and he cultivates a deep sense of righteousness. But that also makes him a truly committed fighter in battle. He is good at war, he pronounced. Just don't tarry over long with him afterwards. In time, and with sufficient drink, his speech becomes depressingly banal. Ego can be a powerful tool, if properly deployed, I said sagely. I need boldness for this expedition, and Caswallon has an abundance. That will be required, as we will be attacking Shakathet's horde in unorthodox fashion, and against overwhelming odds. Our objectives are to do as much damage in as little time as possible, then slip away through the ways. Caswallon is capable of that. We just get to hear him narrate it the entire time. I find my strength in my balance, not my ego, Landric said, shaking his head. And I find mine in the promise of a dram of spirits in civilized company after a stunning victory, Astaral replied, to which quaint little corner of your desolate land are we visiting first, Min? He asked. The Scruggs have just arrived at Forgemont, but they've been at Fort Destiny for hours, I reported. I'd like to pay the Iron Band a visit and see if they need assistance yet. And he wants to see the enemy deployed in these little divisions with his own eyes, Astaral explained to the newcomers. If they are as poor at siegecraft as Gaja Katar, he wants to know it. He also wants to give the bandsmen some hope, Landric suggested. Fort Destiny is the weakest of the castles facing a siege. The more we can strengthen their resolve in the early hours, the longer they will hold. Fort Destiny, came Caswallon's booming voice from above. He vaulted the stair rail with an unnecessary demonstration of his agility and raised his face defiantly. We go to succor the brave fellows of the Iron Band. That's the idea, Astaral nodded indulgently. Perhaps the Blade of the Fox will defend Destiny itself. Oft has the fox heard Destiny's call, and always has he hearkened to it, Caswallon assured us confidently, as I led them over to the snowstone pillar that contained Megalyn's waystone. Ishi's tits, why do you encourage him? Landric complained to Astaral in a whisper. He'll be making metaphorical comparisons to Destiny all day now. Chapter 19 The Unexpected Mission. The spells of the elves are subtle, but do not mistake subtlety for weakness. Mage Lord Proverb, from the collection of Janik the Rish. Fort Destiny was an old, square Wilderlord keep, surrounded by a curtain wall with towers at each corner of the rough rectangle. After it had fallen in the initial invasion, it was used as an advance base by the Gavanni until the nascent Iron Band drove them out and claimed the place as their own. Since the renaming, the Iron Band had steadily improved its defences. The walls were 9 feet taller now, and a new section enclosed a second bailey. The towers were reinforced and a second, deeper ditch surrounded the original moat. A new gatehouse loomed impressively over the approach, and a series of covered turrets had been built along the front stretch of wall. Inside, the range of halls and barracks had greatly expanded from the original construction as the needs of the band increased. During most times, Fort Destiny had 800 or 900 permanent fighting men. Now more than 2,000 crowded the interior. Sandoval had taken great pains to augment the armories with arrows, spears, helms, crossbows, and whatever else Vanador could spare. The storehouses were packed with supplies, enough to endure a lengthy siege. Once we arrived at Fort Destiny, it only took a few moments of observation to realize that all of those preparations were woefully inadequate. The force assembling just out of bowshot vastly outnumbered the defenders. There were at least 7,000 or 8,000 Gavanni and a dozen trolls setting up a siege camp at the bottom of the road leading to the fortress. A half-dozen siege worms were dragging great wains containing partially assembled siege engines into place. Unlike Gaja Katar's horde, the deployment was orderly and businesslike. Depressingly so. What was worse was the hail of incoming magic already being directed at the defences. The head of the Order's magical corps was consumed with defensive efforts, attempting to adapt the wards and shields around the castle to the arcane assault. A squadron of war magi huddled in a tower performing the castings, the high magi among them executing spells prepared by their less powerful colleagues to defend against the probing of incoming magic. They weren't unsuccessful, but whoever was directing the magical assault was no mere Gavanni shaman. The keep shook periodically when their counterspells were inadequate. "They are using Alka Alon's spells of sorcery," Timoniel announced with a sigh as he scanned the battlefield. "Spells as were once used against the great houses, long ago. Spells that haven't been employed since." The Terra Alon warrior sounded both grim and intrigued. "Even learning these spells has been discouraged in my short lifetime." "They don't seem to be particularly effective," Landric said hopefully. As if to mock him, a magically propelled rock the size of his head penetrated the wards and disintegrated on the tower above and behind us, along with 10 feet of crenellated wall. To his credit, Landric did not flinch. "I've seen worse," he added with a shrug, as cries of alarm rose around us. "Was the approach seeded with war spells?" Astoral asked the war mage the Iron Band had assigned us as liaison when we arrived. "Thoroughly." The dark-haired man nodded. "I was observing as they arrived on our frontier," he reported. "We were warded up as tight as a burgher's daughter. Their scouts included some user of magic with them who dismantled them before they could take effect. Same with the outer spell fields." "Well, if Shakathet learned anything about Gaja Katar's failures against us, it's that we like to make our foes step into a big steaming pile of magic before they fight," I said. My baculus, Insight, was in hand, evaluating the battlefield's thaumaturgic structure. It quickly identified a staggered line of force that indicated the likely origins of the spells being lobbed at us. The baculus confirmed Timoniel's report as the blasts of energy erupted against Fort Destiny. Those were Alka Alon sorcerers slinging those spells, sophisticated, powerful, and deadly. There were at least 7 or 8 of them, as well as areas where Insight helpfully suggested future threats might arise based on the arcane forces coalescing there. There was also a significant band of what had to be defensive magic enveloping the encampment, particularly around the 3 great siege engines that were being assembled, and around a structure that looked like a hastily constructed redoubt near the rear of the camp, the sort of place where commanders and sorcerers would congregate. "We're still holding our own," Barroso said confidently. They're just taking our range, Tamanil corrected, as a lance of green light narrowly missed the topmost spire of the castle. They're setting up their field of attack and establishing the spell's perimeters. When that is done, they will begin the real work. Then how best do we disrupt that? Astaroth asked. Quickly, Tamanil said, as his eyes darted back and forth across the line. The Enshadowed haven't fought a war in centuries, but when they did, they preferred highly destructive spells in battle. That's how they destroyed Castabriel. Concussive waves, sonic blasts, desiccation, all manner of brutal magic. This quaint little hut won't be able to withstand that sort of thing for long, he predicted, looking around at Fort Destiny's towers with disdain. They're too spread out for us to attack collectively, and individually they are close enough to summon reinforcements, Landric assessed. We could start at one end, but it's doubtful we'd reach the other before being overwhelmed. And that's a potent defensive field, he added, with a nod toward the invisible force protecting the Enshadowed. That field prevents anything straightforward from getting through, Astaroth concluded after reviewing with his own baculus, at least from this direction. Do we have any units positioned to conduct a flanking or rear attack? He asked the Iron Band mage, hopefully. Nay, my lord, the man said, shaking his head. We have some cavalry, a gracious number, thanks to the new recruits from an Ultramar. But they were deployed with Lord Tyndall's cavalry, away to the east. We've naught but a few scouts hiding in the woods. Those damned fellhounds are keeping them holed up, he added, with a special disgust. They might be spread out, I realized, but they're also in a straight line, more or less. Bide, gentlemen, I said, as a method.